Thank you, Jonathan.
Good morning. In my 31 years as a public school teacher, somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 students passed through my classrooms in various schools, mostly in the Des Moines district. Today's speaker, Sergeant Paul Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department, was one of those students at Meredith Middle School more than 30 years ago. Teachers usually see students for about 9 months and then pass them on to the next level. Some of those students make an impression, and Paul Parizic was one who did. You'll have to forgive me, Paul, because I don't remember if you were in my 7th or my 8th grade language arts class. Time has a way of blurring things. I do, however, remember where you sat in the classroom. I also remember, in addition to your alliterative name, who could ever forget the way Paul Parizic kind of trips off the tongue, that you were one of the nicest kids I ever taught. You, of course, moved on to high school and into your career in law enforcement. Imagine my surprise as I was watching the local news a few years back, and you appeared as a spokesperson for the Des Moines Police Department. I was so proud of your accomplishments. I am not surprised that Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert chose you to join his staff as the department's public information officer. He obviously saw in you the qualities I observed when you were so much younger. Officer Parizic was selected in 2012 as the Des Moines Rotary Club's Police Officer of the Year. The following year, he was promoted to the rank of sergeant. Throughout his career, Sergeant Parizic's investigative interests have focused on criminal gangs with an emphasis on outlaw motorcycle gangs. In 2011, Parizic was honored as the Midwest Outlaw Motorcycle Gang Investigators Association's top cop. He continues his interest in this topic by instructing the gang recognition and investigation classes at both the Des Moines Police Regional Academy and the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. Sergeant Parizic is a 2016 graduate of the Northwestern University Center for Public Safety School Police Staff and Command. Outside of work, he's a proud husband and a father of three. He's an avid bicyclist and a rabid Cubs fan. Please join me in welcoming Sergeant Paul Parizic.
I didn't expect the part about school, so that was really cool. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys inviting me here. This is one of those things that I love doing. There's nothing I like more than getting out and telling our story, the story of the police department and the DMPD family. I have zero background in public relations or any kind of marketing. So I've kind of been, Chief Wingert and I have been buddies for 20 years. And there's a few times I fell in under his command over the years, and every time I was there, you know, the friend thing was always there, but I always felt that mentoring thing too. He's always kind of bumping me along. And I spent between a couple different agencies, I spent about 19 years on the street, and he was finally like, it's time to come inside, you know, and see how the other half lives. And I did not want to go into an office, but when he was Major Wingert, he brought me in. I was his, basically his assistant in headquarters, and got my first look at how things really work. Greatest experience I've ever had. And then when he got promoted to chief, he said, hey, have I got a deal for you? And if he ever says that to any of you, turn and run the other way. Because that's his words, or his way of saying, hang on to your pants, this one's going to get crazy. So he said, hey, you want to come up to the chief's office with me? And I thought, yeah, that's great, man. I'll go work for the chief. You know? And I got to thinking, I said, there's only one job for a sergeant up there. You know, that's the PIO. And I thought, man, I can't do that. And if you go up to our Office of Professional Standards and you look at my file, the few times I've had complaints is because I can't keep my mouth shut. And he said, that's fine. I want you to do you. He said, get out there, call it like it is. There's a new sheriff in town, or chief, and we're going to kind of change the way we do things. We're going to shake it up, and you're part of it. And I thought, oh, okay. You know, it's better to ask for forgiveness, I guess, than permission, so here it goes. And so that's where we are. And I had a couple things I thought about. You know, what do I want to share with a group like this? And I just thought about four things like that I really want you to know going into 2018, just about organizationally how the Des Moines Police Department's operating. And Mr. Person just assured me that you're going to ask questions because I do my best work there, apparently. And I look around the room and I'm a little nervous because I see some faces I recognize, you know, like Mr. McCoy and Mr. Wilson, and there's some smart dudes in here. And I'm used to dealing with, you know, like the new journalists that, you know, that say things like, so, you know, other than, you know, the fact that he's dead by the river on April Fool's Day, what makes this suspicious? So that one I can answer. So take it easy on me. But the big things about the police department right now that we want to talk about, and we were just kind of having a side conversation about our body cameras. That's something that always comes up, and it's, how's that going? We're about a year into it. It's one of the best things that's ever happened to our organization. You know, they do a couple of different things, and we kind of predicted this a little bit, but to actually see it play out. But we've talked about, and I've said this on the news, that when people are watching, people modify their behavior. It doesn't matter who's watching, it's going to happen. We've modified our behavior. Not that we were rogue or anything beforehand, but our complaints have plummeted. And usually it's a kind of an interesting thing when you see somebody come in, they want to scream and yell, hey man, this cop did this, he was horrible to me, he was rude. And we're like, all right, let's sit down and watch the video. And they're like, whoa. What do you mean? Well, they sit down, and sometimes people do, and it's amazing when you see people sit down and go, you know what, that's not what it sounded like. That's not, you know, that wasn't what, how it happened. You know, that's not what I thought was going on. My wife says I do this all the time. You know, I wasn't listening to what you're saying. I was listening to the way you're saying it. So, and sometimes you tell me something I don't want to hear, and that's not nice. Well, you know, it's not bad either. So the body camera thing is moving along. It's very, very expensive, and I think that's one of the challenges with the community. Is that why you guys, what's this budget thing? Why are you always asking for money? And the Guardian Project, which is, again, one of the greatest things that's ever happened to us, and it's an organization of people here in the community that go out and raise money, and that's what got us over the hump with the body camera initiative. If we had not had the support of the Guardian Project, we would not have been able to do this without cutting somewhere else. We would have had to rob Peter to pay Paul within that department, and we work about as thin as we can. We're authorized 376 officers, and that sounds like a lot, but that's the way it's been for about 30 years. Things, you know, this city's grown, this city's changed, and we've kind of been stuck in this spot. Now, Chief Wingert has come up with some very, very creative ways to deploy our resources and some great ways, and he can negotiate, and he's negotiated the unfreezing of some spots that were frozen. So we're going to grow gradually over the years. We still have to worry about attrition. We're just like other organizations where, you know, you got a lot of people retiring right now. We're trying to bring in and backfill. Problem with a young agency, you know, inexperience, not a lot of life experience. And I'll talk about that a little bit more when we get in. But to finish the body camera piece, the one thing that a lot of people in the community don't understand that we hope we're really trying to communicate is that camera that we wear on our uniforms, it's not very expensive at all. It's that back office stuff. We're millions of dollars invested in how are we going to save this information. Do we go server? Do we go cloud? How are we going to redact information? And that takes you down the road of, you know, the open records issues. You know, these laws were written, and I think the last time the open records law was revised was like 1980 or something like that. And this stuff didn't exist. And, you know, the body cameras didn't exist. So how do you apply legal or laws that are written around the idea of a document you can hold in your hand? You know, we were talking about this table here. If we're sitting at the table and Bruce threw a glass at my head, am I obligated to redact everybody else's face out of this? You know, Senator McCoy would be in the background. Do we want to take him out? Because what's that going to do to his career? Everyone say, why are you here? The same thing at the bar with, you know, the senator and the lobbyist. You know, we've got some, I don't know how the rules work up at the Senate, but we've got a thing we call, it's Chapter 1 Standard of Conduct, but the chief refers to it as the jackass clause. And it's like two sentences long. And it's basically, if you do anything that a jackass would do, you're going to get in trouble. And so it's very, very gray. So there's so many different things about how do we handle the body camera. If I come into your house, and let's say your neighbor's a burglar, and this happens, and he sees the police come in there, and we walk out, and he comes down to the station the next day and says, I want the video. I want to see what was going on over there. I'm scared. You know, but he really wants to see what you've got in that living room. So it seems extreme, but these things happen. And then you've got that element out there where people, there's this electronic stuff, the Facebook. I mean, there's that creeper thing going on, and it goes on and on. And my wife works in the media, and I see it with her. She gets harassed on Twitter and Facebook, and you know, people change their profiles. So there's just so much going on with technology that we got to really modify how we do business. Another thing that I thought was kind of important to mention was our implicit bias training. This is something that we're really ahead in the police, our police department, when you look at agencies around the nation, and Drake kind of spearheaded this effort. And implicit bias, basically, if you're not familiar with it, is we all have biases, whether we're born with them or we're raised with them, that's debatable, but we all have them, whether we think we do or not. I went through this training and learned that I really like elderly people. And I think it's because I like to sit around and tell stories, and they like to listen, and they like to do the same thing. That's the only thing I can think of. And that I don't have a lot of patience for millennials. And I thought, no, that can't be. And then I went to a political panel the other night, and it was all about politics and millennials. And the more I listened to them talk, the more I thought, yeah, I don't like you guys. But the implicit bias training that we go through gives us the tools to recognize that and be able to kind of put the brakes on and look at people differently and look at perspectives differently. And it really helps us police differently and police more effectively, because we're asked to do a lot of things that we don't necessarily get a lot of training for. When I went through the academy, we didn't have the crisis intervention and the mental health training that we do now. Our recruits spend a full 40-hour week just on mental health training and how we can deal with mental health issues as they present themselves to the police department. I'm not embarrassed to say it, because it was just what we did back in the day. If you had a mental health issue and it was this cold out and you're walking down the street barefoot, we might arrest you just to help you. That was our idea of helping you. We might take you to jail to keep you warm and dry until tomorrow. That was the resources that we had. Now we've got mobile crisis workers. We have mental health nurses on wheels that come and help us at a scene. Healthcare is a whole other thing. I think everything that's wrong with healthcare has to do with insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. I'm a policeman, so this is what I do. And so that's really helped us, and particularly with a lot of our younger officers who don't have a wide world view. But the one thing that the millennials do bring into it is they can run with this technology. They're smart people. It used to make me so frustrated when I was on the street and I was a training officer, because I'd watch these cops message back and forth on the computer, and I'd slam that thing shut. And I'm like, we're going to go talk to them. You know, we got to get out and talk. So now we're trying to find the balance of how do we do that? How do we stay on the cutting edge of technology? How do we use these things to make us more effective, more efficient, and faster? But at the same time, how do we keep that personal connection? And the way we do that is through our outreach programs. Our neighborhood-based service delivery program is probably one of the longest-lasting programs of its kind. It's phenomenal. It puts cops in neighborhoods. The neighbors have their cell phone numbers. If you have an issue that's not an emergency, you give us a call.
You're fine.
Okay, somebody left one. Okay. Is that all right? Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Now I know not to cuss. So that's one of the best things we have. Our youth programs, they're growing constantly. We just redid our boxing club. Bill Knapp was a big contributor to that, and that we were very fortunate to have that, because we wouldn't have been able to afford it otherwise. We do football programs, we do biking, we do a little bit of everything, because we figure, it used to make me crazy when I'd be out somewhere and somebody would say they'd have their kid. This happened to me the other day. I was getting ice cream and kid's doing something. Mom's like, yeah, he's gonna take you to jail if you don't be good. I think, no, I'm not. I'm not gonna take you to jail. You're not doing anything. You're being a kid, but you need to straighten up. We don't want the kids to be afraid of the police. You know, these are the people who are gonna police me when I'm older. So I wanna make sure that we got the best out there. And our recruiting and hiring is probably one of our greatest priorities right now. And we've changed how we do a lot of things. Social media has taken over quite a bit. I run our Facebook page, and if you follow our Facebook page, be patient, because I didn't do Facebook until they told me I had to. So fortunately, I have a wife who's like a social media maven, and she helps me a lot, needless to say. We try to inject a little humor now and then, some levity, but we don't want to be goofy. because we need to be legitimate. But social media is a way we're reaching out to a lot of the younger folks that we want to recruit. It's another way for us to tell our story a little bit behind the scenes. We go out and we're working a lot with the Latino community. I didn't realize this until I was the PIO, but they were not included on our press release list. And I thought, well, how do they know what we're doing? And I reached out to them and they said, well, we just report off of KCCI or WHO. And I'm like, man, they don't always get it right. So here, get them on our list and bring them to our meetings so that we know them and they know us. We've done the same thing with the Black community. We go to their radio stations and we try and sell the police department for what it is, not what everybody thinks it is, because it's nothing really like what you think it is at times. So those are the big things that we've done. But the bottom line when we start talking about what we want the police department to be is we want to be, and by design, we're going to get the part. We want to be the most visible, and we are, because we drive the fancy cars and we wear these costumes and we do that. So everybody knows, they see us and they know who we are, but we want to be the most viable and the most accessible community partner that this town can have. When people want to talk about Des Moines, we want them to think about the police department. And that's where I've really learned a lot, is that we market our product. And that's something that's kind of new to our industry. But if you don't, something bad's going to happen. You know, look at these towns in North Carolina, or look at Ferguson. You're one thing away from somebody saying, what happened? You know, I want to know what happened. That's wrong. And if you don't have a good answer, and if you don't, the biggest thing is, if you don't have the relationship where you can have the conversation, you're never going to get ahead. And the best example I had of that was we had two police officers killed in March of 2016. We had a memorial set up in front of the police department that grew very, very fast. Constant people coming and flowers and cards. And it was just this probably one of the most heartwarming things I've ever experienced in my life. On the heels of that, we had our narcotics officers doing an investigation over in the East Village. A man ran from them. They chased him. They tackled him. One of the officers thought that he had seen something in this man's mouth, thought he had drugs in his mouth. They took him to the hospital. He was at the hospital for hours, kept denying it, didn't do it. Basically refused a lot of the medical attention that was offered to him. And I think it was 4 hours there at the hospital. Sent him up to the jail. He went up to the jail. He died. Had a stomach full of heroin. There was going to be a protest in front of our police department. Now, are we cool with that? We're totally cool with that. I sat in the chief's office one day and watched a different protest as they pulled police station letters, the letters from the words off the front of our sign. You know, we can replace that. You know, we're going to fix that. So we are very supportive of people having their civil voice. Now, when this protest was coming, obviously emotions were very, very high in our department. And we could see this stirring within our people that, like, no way, they are not going to do this out there where we've got this memorial set up. We said, yeah, they are, and we're going to talk to them about it. We're going to try and do what we can to facilitate the conversation and let them have their space to have their voice. And we were able to do that because of the relationships we built over the past quarter century. It was 25 years we really changed our community policing model, and that was under Chief Bill McCarthy, who was a visionary. Difficult man at times, but a visionary. So they were able to have their protest out there, and we were able to have our memorial. And everything went fine. Everything went smooth. And that's because we have that equity built up in our community. Because you're just one questionable shooting away from a riot. And I tell other cops this all the time. One questionable shooting away from things just falling apart. So you got to do your homework. You got to go out there and do this thing first and build those relationships. And we talk a lot about relationships, but man, that's the bottom line. So I do want to open this up to people asking questions, because that's, like I said, that's where I kind of do my best work. So, yes, sir.
How, with the social media and like back page and stuff like that with human trafficking, how much of a challenge is that? And when I know, like, you used to see somebody prostitute, arrest them immediately, send them to jail, what resources are available to find out that person's really a victim and needs help?
That's something that we've been working with our vice guy. And the state kind of led the charge on this, on the sex trafficking. And they've got some people specifically assigned to that. And we've educated our vice and narcotics officers to be aware and look for that also. The state, the real teeth are in the federal laws when it comes to that. There is a state law, and we have charged a man, I think 3 years ago during the state fair, with sex trafficking. And it's something, it's just another one of those issues where you just have to raise awareness. As far as the social media and the internet part goes, we creep on the internet all the time. When I was working our outlaw motorcycle gang projects, I had a bogus Facebook page set up. I just went on PhotoBucket and I thought, well, what do I need? I need a picture of a really attractive lady in a bikini standing next to a motorcycle. And I said, all right, well, that's me. And I found it and I made a page and I said, I love bikers, and it was like bait. So we do a lot of similar things. If you're out there creeping around the internet, and I tell the news this all the time, careful when you're setting up those dates, because it might be us. And sometimes it is. So, but we read, and I think Craigslist took down their personals recently. So I think their industry is starting to take it a little more serious. The problem with getting, you know, your Craigslist and your Backpage and those places to take it serious is that they're all about money. They don't know, they don't see the face. So as far as that goes, it's been a lot of education in our department, a lot of legal wrangling to get some laws changed and get some momentum going so that we can start these investigations. But interagency cooperation has been huge on that, working with the feds, working with the state, and having that relationship again, you know, the relationship piece. Yes, sir.
The so-called sanctuary city bill that just passed, really, I think it has a lot of consequences. A lot of them impact how you police and how you work in the community. Dan has talked about it. Sheriff McCarthy's talked about it. Any thoughts on how you will deal with that? I know law enforcement is against that. We fought it. Now we got to live with it, I guess.
Okay, so I was chastised by higher than the chief for some of the comments I made about this, but I thought we were really in line, and the police department got positive feedback. It blows, Paul Parizek speaking here, it blows my mind that this stuff is, people are actually looking at this type of legislation as legitimate and good for our community. I suppose I'll keep it pretty, what I told people, and I don't know why this offended anybody, but we really don't care where you're from, and we don't care how you got here. If you pick up your phone and you call 911, we're going to come and we're going to give you the help that you need. Now, on the other hand, to calm the fears of people who think I'm just opening our gates and saying, "What? If you run afoul of the law in Des Moines, we're going to take you to jail. We don't care where you came from, and we don't care how you got here. So if you're going to be here and you're going to be part of what we see as community, I don't know what the problem is. I don't know what the problem is. Now, I understand, and this is way above my pay grade, I understand there are concerns about, you know, health care and all those things. I think before we start thinking about, you know, I'm originally from West Texas. I'm literally a nine iron from Mexico. And I recall as a kid being able to walk across the river with a couple of nickels from my dad and come back with my pockets stuffed full of candy. And nobody told me to go home. Nobody told me I couldn't do that. Nobody bothered me, nothing. Now, if you go to the town that I lived in as a child, Del Rio, Texas, it's a freaking war zone now. I mean, it's unbelievable. So we got a bunch of bigger things we need to worry about, not this. And if you want to talk about the healthcare part, again, it's the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies that create these obstacles for us to be able to access those things without it being such a financial burden on those of us who do carry insurance. So, to answer your question, Senator, you pick up the phone, call 911, we're coming. And we really don't care what you are, but we're going to help you out the best we can. And that's a tight rope for the sheriff and the chief to walk, because there's a lot of politics involved. And from my position, the times that I have had somebody say, hey, come here, you might want to just stop for a second, it's because I'm not real politically savvy sometimes, and I kind of get in these conversations, and I don't think about that. And sometimes I've been wrong for not thinking about it, because the county-city relationship is big. So that's, does that help you out, sir?
Yeah.
All right. Yes, sir.
Do you routinely receive requests from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to go and arrest someone who they believe to be in the country illegally if you have no other law enforcement interest in them?
No.
You do not.
No, they don't do that. And I think there's also kind of sometimes a misconception that the feds have unlimited resources. They don't. When they, like, if you see on the news that there's a big operation where they have come in and gone to a packing plant and they're arresting a bunch of people at a packing plant, I'd say the overwhelming majority of those agents aren't from Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. They aren't even from Iowa. They come in from somewhere else, and this is something that is. And that's the other thing with some of the federal agencies that I personally have always thought was just a little bit frustrating. They might have a special agent in charge here in Des Moines, and that's cool, but they've got somebody in Kansas City calling the shots, or they've got somebody in Omaha calling the shots. And go back to your question, we're not, I think we're a pretty approachable organization, and we're a friendly organization, but we still don't like somebody telling us how to do our job. I think we're doing it pretty darn good. So the relationship that we have with the feds is pretty good, but they understand that we don't have authority to enforce immigration laws. And there's some serious flaws with how they throw us into that arena sometimes. I recall when I was still working midnight patrol one night, I stopped a guy, thought he was drunk, over on the east side. He hadn't had a drop of drink. Man had been working all night long at Firestone, and he's finally going home. Probably did a 10 to 12 hour shift. Couldn't really understand because we had a little bit of a language issue. He's a Hispanic man. But he hadn't done anything wrong. I mean, he had done something wrong, but he wasn't doing anything wrong. And I think the mere presence of a police officer woke him up enough that he was going to get home okay. But dispatch called me on the radio and said, hey, this guy's got an ICE warrant. And I'm like, what is that? So what do I do with that? Well, you got to call New Hampshire. And then New Hampshire's going to have to do a little research. And then they're going to call you back. And then they're going to do this. And they're going to do that. And I'm like, okay. And so I sat there and had conversation with this man the best we could. And put him at ease a little bit. And I finally just decided, you know what? I can't stop you and hold you for 20 minutes on the side of the road. That's what the Supreme Court says. I get enough time to do my business. And if I haven't done my business by then and there's nothing to justify keeping it going, then, you know, you can go home. Well, he can go home, you know, because they're going to drag their tails. You know, their system doesn't work all the time. I let him go. Now, that was a mistake, apparently. but it, you know, so what? I mean, it worked out great. So, yeah.
Recently, the FBI has been in contact with the Pride Center here in town, and they've got one of our members involved in what's called Citizen Academy.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if the police department has something, or you have an auxiliary group that works in that area.
Yeah, we host the Citizens Academy. I think what we've been trying to do is do one annually. But what, and this is not a bad thing, we have one academy building. We do in-service there for, like, I was just out there for in-service recently. We've got an academy class going. So we right now don't have the space to do it. And we've got another academy class. We're trying to get our staffing up. But we do host those things. And they're really, really cool. I'll tell you something about a Citizens Academy. So I know there's a lot of attorneys in here. So we did a shoot, don't shoot thing. You know who the first ones were to pull the trigger the fastest? Attorneys. I don't know what it is. I mean, it might be that black and white thing, you know, but man, they just boom, unloading on them. And always in the right scenario. But, you know, they didn't take the couple steps back like we take and, hey, stop. Hey, can we do something else? They were like, boom, boom, boom. So, it's a really nice thing also for people to get a little bit of some insight into how we do business. And I'll push our Facebook a little bit here because I kind of got approval to do something that I think will be kind of interesting and it'll serve kind of the same purpose. But I want to start profiling our officers, just picking a cop, letting them write a little story about themselves, and then putting it out there so people know. Chief Wingert, his very words to me a long time ago, and this was just a tavern conversation, was he's like, I want people to know our cops by first name. I want them to know by first name. And I thought, you know, that's cool. And then I got thinking about that, and I said, man, that Facebook, I can use a Facebook for that. But we're going to profile some of our different sections in the department, our identification section. You know, our support staff doesn't get a lot of recognition outside of our walls. And that's a shame sometimes because, you know, we solve crimes just like they do on, you know, investigation discovery. We solve crimes with fingerprints and DNA, and we solve crimes, you know, the traditional way with our detectives sitting in there and just talking and talking and talking and talking. So there's a lot of cool things that are going on and a lot of cool people out there that really we want people to know more about. So the Citizen Academy does that, and so does the social media thing. The technology's jumped off huge. Yes, sir.
The thing about Citizen Academy prompted me to think about something. Whatever happened to the CD auxiliary that Des Moines had many years ago?
The Civil Defense Auxiliary? What we have now, okay, so we have a police reserve unit, and that's actually how I got my start in law enforcement, was with the reserve unit with the West Des Moines Police. And those are just, I mean, we've got business owners on there. Faust Autobody, the man that owns Faust Autobody, is a police reserve officer. Just a variety of people within from in our community that are reserve police officers. They get, I think it's $1 a year just so they can be covered workman's comp and stuff. And they get the same training we do, and they come out and they volunteer their time. The only caveat is they have to work under the guidance or supervision of a certified police officer. But they're certified by the state as reserve officers. And it's a huge time commitment. It's like 120 hours of training that they have spread out over a couple of months. And then they have to go through all of our in-service training. So they got the implicit bias training. They get the annual, you know, we all kind of roll our eyes, but here we go again, we got to listen to the sexual harassment stuff, you know, but yeah, apparently everybody's not listening, you know, so that's why we keep bringing it back. And then we've got, so that's the functional police auxiliary that we have, for using that term.
Then, my question is probably because when we had the CDs, they had their own blue uniforms, it was very obvious.
And we have community ambassadors now. So they don't have they don't take a police role. They are people from the community that, and they wear blue shirts and it says community ambassador on the back. And they just kind of help us facilitate some conversations sometimes when it's difficult. They provide us a lot of support at events like I'll Make Me a World. I've worked that the past few years, they'll come and they'll set up and they'll man our booth and they'll help us out at the fair when we have problems with juveniles. It's amazing sometimes you have a juvenile who won't listen to what a uniformed police officer is saying, but, you know, Mrs. Marsh from down the street comes marching up and starts telling him and shaking her finger and he's like straightened up. And that to me was a huge moment when I saw this happen at the fair. You know, historically we've had some problems out there with kids. And I thought, because when I was a kid, I wasn't worried about the police. I mean, my dad worked for the police department, so, you know, I had a little concern with him, but it wasn't because he worked for the police department. But I was worried about the lady down the block, because she was going to tell on me. You know, she was going to do those things. She was going to let my parents know what I was doing. And that's what we are trying to help rebuild in the city here is a sense of neighborhood, having the communities. We want you to know your neighbors. I know my neighbors. You know, I make a point of introducing myself to them. We want people to do that. And then, so those are and then we have our wives, the police wives have an auxiliary, and they just do what police wives do. They bake sales and t-shirts and stuff like that. And then they show up. But the bigger thing they do, you know, you talk about support staff, you know, my wife, my kids. That's the most support I've ever had is from my family. Those are the folks that keep you going, get you out of bed in the morning and make sure you go to bed at night. And, you know, a funny story about my wife. You know, so she works in the media, so she gets it. She's very patient. My phone, every day, my phone is dinging or donging before 5 o'clock in the morning because that news cycle is 24 hours. She's very, very tall into that. Yeah, she gets a little frustrated sometimes on the weekends if it might interfere with what we're doing. If you guys listened to her sports radio show this morning, she called me out because I showed up to coffee and then the baseball game yesterday, opening day, in my uniform. And I was like, I was working. You know, this is what I do. But one night we were sleeping, and my phone rings, you know, and it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, oh, that's not good. Pick it up. Yeah, we had a homicide. And I'm like, man, that is not good. And I throw my phone on the counter, and I'm like, man, I don't want to go anywhere. She didn't miss a beat. She didn't even roll over. She didn't look at me. She reached back. She patted me on the back, and she said, it's double time Sunday. You need to get out of bed. So, that's good support. Yes, sir.
Paul, there are a few of us in the room who are old enough to remember when the police department wasn't all that friendly to the gay community.
Sure.
To be a slight understatement, I guess. That's completely different now, of course, and that didn't just happen. My question is, what kind of ongoing sensitivity training towards the gay community goes on now with cadets and new officers?
It's another change in how we do things at the academy. When we start talking about the populations that we serve, obviously that population, your population, is huge in this city. And, you know, it's a chicken or egg thing. Did we not treat gay people the right way, and then they kind of hid, or were they hiding, and we didn't give them the access to be themselves? And so, yeah, that's a big piece of our training out there. It goes right along with the mental health training. Well, not right along with the mental health training. Somebody's going to throw a glass in my head, okay? See? I don't do the public relations thing. Sometimes that was just a grammar error. So, but it goes along with how we've changed the topics that we think are important. But the biggest thing is, and this is a conversation, see, this is the cool thing I get to do. I'm the only sergeant that gets to sit around the table with the big guys. You know, the chief, the assistant chief, the majors. I'm on the chief's staff, so I get to sit around and listen to these conversations, and it gives me goosebumps because, yeah, Dan, Chief Winger and I have been great friends. Assistant Chief Tunk, another Hoover Meredith guy, was Al Tunks. You know, Major Dykstra, Major Wehmeyer, all these guys are just brilliant minds, but they're my buddies too, you know. So I always kind of knew they were cool because they're my friends. And then I sit around this table and I'm like, Jesus, these guys are smart. You know, I can't believe this is how it works. But one of the conversations that we had, and this was just a couple of weeks ago, and it was about the community, the gay community, and we were like, it's part of our community. Because somebody had a concern at one time. And we've got an officer, Sergeant Tina Kalar, that's assigned as the liaison, and she's a great lady. But what Chief Winger said, and this kind of hit me, is like, he's like, yeah, but it's part of our family, too. The Des Moines Police Department family. It's part of our family. So why would we treat anybody different than we're going to treat our family? And it's not the blue thing, you know. These are the people that we work with, and you look at what happened to us in 2016, and we came out of that hole. Probably better. We're carrying around a pretty heavy weight. You know, we lost our friends. And that, that was really, it wasn't polarizing at all. It really brought us all together. And so that's, I think, one of the biggest shifts in our thinking is thinking of us as a family, and everybody's included. So, and we tell them that at the academy. And I hit on recruiting and hiring just a little bit ago, but there's one thing I want to... Are you trying to cut me off? Am I running out of time? Okay. All right. I just saw you kind of creeping up, you know.
It's creepy, isn't it?
No, you're a nice guy. So this should tell you something about how serious we take our recruiting and hiring. We had an academy class. We were authorized 22 officers. We were going to hire... city says you can hire 22 cops. We get over 500 applications, and we start weeding people out as it goes on, and the Civil Service Commission certifies a list of 40 people, and we can pick those off of that list of 40 people. That's another misconception that people have sometimes. They're like, why don't you have more minorities in your organization? And I'm like, we don't really pick from a pool of 560. We pick from a pool of 40 that we're given. The Civil Service Commission says these are the people that you can hire, and so we pick off of that. And we picked the best people. So we have 22 spots for an academy class. We hired 19 people because we just weren't comfortable going below that last guy, number 19. We're like, we're not going to put bodies in the seats just to fill them. We want the right people. And that's a huge thing in any organization. Because you're always toying with that. You guys know how everybody's got a job. You know how it works. You know, hey, you didn't use that money, so you must not need it. Well, no, we need it. We need the money. And we need the people, but we need the right people. And that's if you walk out of here with anything, understand that you're the police officers out there right now. We're doing everything we can to make sure you got the best and the brightest. So, yeah. Got time for one more? No? All right.
Appreciate you coming, Paul. And it is a tradition for us to give a token of appreciation to our speakers. This is a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus that we hope you and your wife and family will enjoy.
See, now a millennial wouldn't have a CD player.
I did.
Well, the veneer of civilization is very, very thin and fragile. And we have heard from someone this morning who works where that veneer exists. And that veneer can be very hard, or it can be enlightened and soft. Because even bad guys are still people. And approached appropriately, as you've been describing, can be much more effective in maintaining that veneer in a way that doesn't chafe. And it has been said that anyone who is successful should thank a teacher. Thank you, Steve, for doing such a good job with his students. Okay, our next meeting is going to be May the 4th. Our speaker is going to be Keith Snow, who is the CEO of E2B. Now, this is a perfect follow-up to Ann Seltzer, who was here, who collects data and does that kind of polling. This guy takes the data and manipulates it. And he basically, if he has two, maybe three pieces of information about you, he can tell you what kind of dog food you buy. I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable skill set. And he is going to be fascinating to hear from, I think. So you'll not want to miss our meeting on May the 4th. And then our June speaker is yet to be determined. For a while, we had the executive director of the Tyler Clemente Foundation. And he's had to pull out, so we have another invitation now extended to another potential speaker. And then in July will be Tom Vilsack, former governor and Secretary of Agriculture.
If y'all get my June block, we'll come back, you know.
Very good. And with that, thank you for being here today, and we'll see you in May.
Ryan asked me last night.
Ryan wasn't here.
No, he asked me, texted me last night and asked me to do it, and it was late, and I said, okay, and I totally forgot, and then I was sitting here going, I thought I saw something laying up here, and I thought, well, I wonder if it's being recorded, because I forgot.
Yeah, well, I don't know how long these things go.
Oh, it should keep, well, it's still going. See, we need to stop it.
Oh, well, good. Oh, well, good. I didn't know how long.
Sorry.
Thanks. I didn't know how long they... Yeah, they... Oh, good.